Ladies and gentlemen, I should like to welcome you to our 19th lecture in our series. And this evening, to explain to those of you who may not have read the program or the change in the program, that the Dr. Gibson, who was to speak this evening, spoke on December the 10th. I'm afraid we can't recall him for this evening. And Dr. Ian McTaggart Cowan is taking his place this evening. This was a planned shift as between the two speakers because of the fact that Dr. Taggart Cowan had a meeting in Washington, D.C. on the December meeting. Now, our speaker tonight, as you know, is the head of the zoology department at the University of British Columbia. He comes from a distinguished family of scientists. His brother, too, was a distinguished graduate of ours, and in fact, is receiving an honorary doctor's degree later on this year as recognition of his service in this institution and Canada. Our speaker received his Bachelor of Arts degree here in 1932, and 3 years later went to California, where he received his PhD. Although he's written a great deal on the subject in his field of zoology and allied subjects, he is principally known, of course, to those of you who have TV sets as the one of our outstanding teachers in science on TV. And the many courses that he's given and the many series that he's conceived has, of course, added greatly to the some of our knowledge and our educational facilities in British Columbia and in Canada. He has had a distinguished career at the university. He has been awarded the Scott Memorial Scholarship, has had both the Carnegie and the Nuffield Traveling Scholarships, and he's a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and a governor of the Arctic Institute. Only recently, he traveled to Russia, representing Canada at a conference there, and he returned and gave an address to the universities, as some of you may have heard, on the subject of his research there. This evening, it is our pleasure to hear him on the subject of mice and men, or the biology of numbers. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Ian McTaggart Cowan.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, this business of animal numbers is an interesting and important one. It's one of certain rather dramatic complexities. I'm always intrigued and amused by the little story that came to me some years ago about the two rabbits on a very pleasant spring morning that were chased into a hollow log by a couple of dogs that were running loose on a hunting spree. It's reported that the rabbits, after being inside the log for a few minutes, turned to one another and said, "Say, let's stay here till we outnumber them." And this they were very well equipped to do. This idea of population increasing geometrically, that is, by means of compound interest, was first rather dramatically put by the now very famous gentleman, Malthus, in 1799. He was referring primarily to the problem of increasing human population. He quite clearly saw that mankind was increasing at a rate that was bound to bring it into collision with the ceiling as he then conceived it. Now, he made a few errors in calculation. His anticipation was correct, but his distance and rate were incorrect. But I want first to look critically at a number of animal situations because of their intrinsic interest to us in understanding the whole business of the performance of animal populations. And when we've done this, then, I think we'll turn back and relate what we have seen to the human environment and to human population itself. Now, it's well known to all of you, of course, that different kinds of animals have very different potential rates of increase. A friend of mine once kept a pair of field mice, at least he had a pair for a few days, in captivity. And he records, this was Dr. Vernon Bailey, one time chief of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He records that in 1 year, this pair of field mice, at least the female, had 13 litters that produced a total of 78 animals. And by the time that she had produced her 78th, her daughter, by the first adventure, had produced herself 11 litters and was running her mother a very close second. So that actually he had his whole basement full of field mice as the result of a very innocent beginning 12 months before. Of course, not all animals are equipped with such an ability to increase, but even those with a relatively limited rate of increase can do surprising things when you start to add up all the numbers. If, for instance, you take the deer. Now, a deer is a relatively slow increasing creature. We have a very objective experiment, experiment that has come so close to our calculated maximum rate of increase that it is always cited as a classic. Two bucks and four pregnant does were placed on an island in the Missouri River in 1928. 5 years later, a complete count was made of the deer on that island. It was a drive made on the island, and every deer counted. There were 160 deer there. Now, this was the product of just these six animals in 5 years. So even deer then can very quickly fill any environment that's offered to them. This rate of increase, incidentally, from 6 to 160 in 5 years was 65% compound interest. Each doe, 1.3 young per year. Elephants, of course, have a much lower rate of increase. Mankind has a very variable rate of increase. At present, so far as I can estimate, man is increasing at the approximate average annual interest rate of about 12%, a rate that he has never previously achieved so far as we have any awareness. Now, when we come to study this business of animal populations, we are prone to add up our numbers so that we can see them in some sort of a graphical picture. And there are two ways in which you can usefully look at these numbers. One of these is by each year simply raising a column or putting a spot on our graph to indicate the number of animals or people that we have this year. So that then, if we are in studying a population in an environment that is suitable, say these deer on this newly delivered island, we will find the lower part of a curve that has a very characteristic shape. It's shaped like a great figure S, somewhat falling over on its face. So if you imagine the graph is here, and we have time along this axis and numbers going up the scale, we have a graph that is shaped with a very sharp increase on the way up, and then it starts to flatten out at the top. This is called the summation curve, and it is typically S-shaped. Now, the shape of this curve is extremely important, and it's a very simple graph, and I'm sure you've all seen it and can all follow it. The other graph, which we can raise immediately underneath our S-shaped graph, is the graph, what we call the graph of increment. In making this graph, we don't concern ourselves with the total number of animals every year. We concern ourselves only with the new animals added each year. It's the curve of increment. And this graph, instead of being S-shaped, is shaped like a school bell sitting on the teacher's desk. In other words, it starts off low, rises to a peak, and then gradually falls again to a very low level. Now, it's interesting to find that the peak of this bell-shaped curve, the curve of new animals added each year, lies immediately under the middle of the S-shaped curve, the number of total animals present in our population every year. Now, this is extremely interesting. What is happening at the beginning of a population that is increasing is that each year the population is adding a certain fixed percentage, the same percentage every year. Say, in this deer population, 65% of each parent population is added each year in terms of new young. So you've got then compound interest, and the curve rises very steeply. But all of a sudden, you find that this percentage is not the same every year. that instead of adding 65% one year, you've only added 60%. And the next year it falls to 55%, and the next to 50, and your curve is gradually looping over at the top until all of a sudden that you find you're adding 0% per year, and the population is then stable. This is when your bell-shaped curve of new animals has gone all the way back down to base level again. Now, this is a very simple concept. It's a very simple graph, but it's absolutely characteristic of all animal populations living in a world that is big enough to support this type of population. There have been some dramatically different kinds of populations. For instance, the reindeer were introduced onto St. Paul Island in the Pribilof group. Now, St. Paul is not a big island. They increased to the top of their curve and then all of a sudden disappeared entirely. In other words, they just went over the edge into oblivion. This is a signal that the world was not big enough for them. And it's one of the things that can happen to an animal population. Their environment was too small for an animal of that size. Mice wouldn't have done it on that island. They've been there for generations. So this then is something that I want you to think about with me for a few moments. What is happening then? First, as we stop adding the same percentage to our population every year, we first start to add the same number every year. And then we add less than the same number every year. And finally, we add nothing at all. Obviously, something very radical has happened to that population. And it didn't happen to it at the top. It happened to it at the point where they were no longer adding the same percentage to the population every year. This is where it began to happen. At this stage, every animal looked healthy. If you went into that population, you'd say this was a fine population, healthy, thriving. The females were all alert. The young were well nourished and running around, but they just weren't adding the same percentage every year. And whether we can detect it or not, something has obviously happened. And it is the task of the biologist, the student of animal populations, to try and put his finger on just what this happening has been. I'd like then to look at a few other opportunities. Obviously then, this animal population has been moving up against a ceiling. There was an upper limit. There could only be so many deer on this George Island in the Missouri River. It wouldn't hold any more than that. Now, when we were studying them, it hadn't reached that point. Since then, it has. And the population has stopped this rising and has flattened out at the top. However, obviously, this isn't a fixed ceiling. It's not like trying to build up blocks in this room until it hit the ceiling, and then you couldn't put any more blocks there. Obviously, this ceiling is an elastic ceiling. It's almost like bounding upwards against a great cushion of sponge rubber. And it will start to hold your bounce down the moment you hit the sponge rubber, but your head may be able to penetrate 3 or 4 feet into it before you come to a full stop and come down again. This, then, is the sort of ceiling that animal populations face as they expand in their environment. And another unfortunate thing or interesting thing about the ceiling that supervenes on animal populations is that it's not always in the same place. We're quite used to the fact that that ceiling is perhaps 20 feet high, and it would be very embarrassing to turn around day after tomorrow and find it was only 8 feet high. But this, of course, is what happens to ceilings on wild populations. Something can radically change the total number of animals that can live in an environment because the seasons alter the food potential of any area very quickly. If you get a deep snow, for instance, as I've seen it so dramatically happen on the Rocky Mountain ranges, animals will be buried to their necks in a heavy snow that they can't plow through. Now, the ceiling has been lowered on them. We might almost say the boom has been lowered on them. They can go nowhere, they can get nothing to eat, and everything, or virtually everything in that area, will die, except those that had the good fortune to be snowed in underneath an edible bush. And they only hope the bush lasts long enough for the snow to melt. This is when it's reasonably useful to be bushed. If I may be pardoned a horrible pun. Actually, of course, the very animals themselves can alter the capacity of the population of the environment to support their own kind. Now, the biologist has a term for all the things in the environment which, added together, stop a population from realizing its maximum rate of increase. They call this environmental resistance. It's a very useful term because, like so many terms used by man, it doesn't mean anything. But it sounds good, and it does express an idea. This is simply the sum total of things, known and unknown, that prevent an animal from doing what we know it should be able to do in terms of increase. And we always set about to try and estimate these various items in the environmental resistance. What we're looking for, of course, is the key item, because most of the time that we're busy with finding out about animal populations, we're interested in doing something with those populations. If it's deer, we're either interested in increasing the size of populations if you're a hunter, or decreasing them if you're a farmer trying to raise an orchard on their winter range. And we want to find out just what it is that's holding this population from going no further. Why is it that over 50 years we have had virtually no increase of bighorn sheep in the Ashenola River Valley, when there's apparently lots of food and the young ones are born and they look healthy and they get through their first summer in fine shape and they come back to the winter range in fine shape and they don't seem to die in the wintertime, but by the end of next summer there aren't any? Something has put the lid on them, and it's difficult often to find out. Now, there have been some very interesting questions asked about these things, and some very interesting answers discovered. Many things, obviously, can influence the rate at which a population increases: the number of young per litter or brood, the frequency of litters or broods, the age of the animals before they have their first young, the survival, both prenatal and postnatal, of the young that are conceived, the breeding habits, are they monogamous or are they polygamous, the proportion of the population at any one age that's actually breeding. Now, this may involve a lot of things. If a large proportion of your population is overbreeding age or underbreeding age, then you're not dealing with the real population when you're talking about the whole number that you can count. It's only those that are breeding that are important in the increase. Now, one of the most ingenious questions that's been asked, a very simple one, anybody could ask it, anybody could seek the answer, was, why don't robins lay more eggs? Now, this is a very fundamental question, not only to robins, but to us. We all of you know that robins lay either 3 or 4 eggs. They don't lay 2 and they don't lay 5. Why? You would think that the main purpose of robins was to have more robins, and that the more eggs they laid, the more robins they would have, and that this would be good business. Except for your cherry trees. You see, there's all sorts of attitudes about animals at every stage. David Lack of the Bureau of Animal Populations at Oxford asked himself this question, and he proceeded to take the very simple way of finding out. He selected a number of robins' nests, and he subsidized their egg supply with eggs that he'd stolen from another robin, so that a number of robins found themselves with 5 or 6 eggs in their nests. He then followed their young through to maturity and found that the ones with 5 or 6 eggs actually came out with fewer fledged young than the ones that had the right number. He did this puzzled him, so he did it with starlings and he did it with swifts. Starlings lay 5 eggs, swifts lay 2. And some of the swifts found themselves raising 4 young, or trying to. In point of fact, they came out with either 1 or none. Whereas if they had 2 eggs, hatched 2 young, they came out with 2. So obviously then, the number of eggs that these birds were laying was related to their potential ability to feed the young in a very significant way. An interesting answer, and a very important one, when we consider this whole business of why do individual animals have only a certain number of young. Another interesting question frequently arises. This concerns, I'm just going to pick out a few questions at random because the whole field is too big to canvass thoroughly, the question of different death rates in the two sexes. Now, this has always been a puzzler. Why is it that there are, when you have a theoretically equal chance of having male and female children, why is it that under certain circumstances there are more males born in the whole population than there are females, and in other circumstances the reverse? And why is it that this happens in animals other than man? And why is it that once they're born, more boy babies and deer male fawns die before they mature than female fawns and female children? Well, this I can't answer for man. I don't think the answer is yet. But I can answer it for deer. I know more about deer than I do about men. It's a tragic thing to have to say, but so few zoologists actually are studying man. Virtually none of them. The question was answered very interestingly by a Californian biologist, a very good friend of mine. And he took the ingenious view that every time he saw a doe with her fawns, that he was able to sex. He was able to tell that, well, this is a buck fawn, that's a doe fawn. He noted the distance between the fawns and their mother. And every time he saw a fawn without a mother, he was particularly zealous to note the sex of this young one. And he found that on the average, the male fawns were three times as far away from their mothers as the female fawns. And whenever you found one all by himself, it was almost certain to be a male. The males are just more adventuresome from the very beginning. And they get themselves into all sorts of grief that their sisters don't get into. And those of you that have got children of both sexes know exactly what I mean. Those of you who are busy paying the automobile insurance rate for your young males will also know exactly what I mean. A very real reflection of the same sort of thing in man as we find in animals. But this carries on right through. And once the animal becomes an adult, I worked with an elk population at one time in the Rocky Mountain parks, and I found that in Banff Park, for instance, in an untouched herd, a herd of elk that could do just as it liked, roam where it went, wanted to, and was immune from hunters, the adult sex ratio was 72 cows to 28 bulls. And they were 50-50 at birth. Obviously, something very different was happening to the males and to the females. And it wasn't too difficult to find out what. The males here were more venturesome. Again, they were exploring ahead of the herd, and you'd get whole bands of bulls alone, just big bachelor parties, about a whole mountain range ahead of the mixed herd of cows and bulls. They had gone up to the summer range on the mountaintops, and then in the winter, they'd gone down the other side to see what was there, presumably. And usually these set up a little nucleus. They did all their bugling and horning of trees and dashing about, but it was all pretty futile because there was nobody listening. But perhaps the second or third summer, some cow that had failed to get a calf spent the summer with the boys on the mountaintops and went down the other side of the hill with them in the fall. And she was the popular nucleus of a new population. So then a large part of the population was tied up in pioneering. Now, isn't this exactly the same as what happens in human pioneering of new continents? It is the males that go first. Any of you that are ornithologists or bird watchers or what you like to call yourself will know that whenever you get what we call extralimitals, that is species way out of their normal range, there are 95 chances out of 100 that's a male. Males just explore, and by exploring, they get into grief, but they also open the world for the population. The penalty is found in difference in numbers. Of course, the antlered animals have another problem. They mate in the fall of the year. The mating experience for the female is a very short one, but the male spends the best part of 3 months thrashing around bushes and chasing women and not eating enough. And the result is that the male goes into the winter in the poorest physical condition that he's been in all year. Well, the female gets all this business out of her system very quickly and goes about the usual even tenor of her housekeeping without too much involvement. I'm not going to draw any parallels here. So then this business of dying can be dramatic and interesting to those that are not concerned. In the greatest number of instances in animal populations, death is highly competitive. The force that actually controls the size of the population is what we call a density-dependent factor. Now, this is a long-sounding word which simply says it's something that kills the population, kills it in larger proportions the larger the numbers that are there to be killed. So then, this is the sort of thing we have to look for as a limiting control, the actual ceiling. than which the animal can't transcend. Now, these density-dependent forces are varied and interesting. But one of the tragic things about it, looked at from human eyes, and our eyes are so different because there's so much goes on behind them that doesn't go on behind the animal eye, is that in animal populations, the most severe competition is between the young and their parents. The young are competitors of the parents, or vice versa, from the moment that they are weaned. And a cow moose with her calf feeding through the winter, the cow is grazing from 3 feet to 8 feet. The calf can only graze from 3 feet to 4 feet because he's little. And he's a pretty poor piece of equipment for resisting cold. He's got a large surface and a small body. His mother is a great big hulk of a creature with a low radiation, good heat conservation. So the little fellow has an impaired chance of coming through the winter, standing right at his mother's heels and competing mouthful for mouthful. So then, survival of the fittest starts at the stage of weaning, if it doesn't start before. Let us now examine certain actual situations to see what it is that can limit animal populations other than food supply. Food supply is the simplest and most obvious source of a ceiling. If there's only just so much to eat, this will set the ultimate limit of animal populations. But there are many, many animal populations that stop far short of the limit of their food supply. And these, to us, are the most interesting ones because they present the greatest challenge, and I think they have in them the seeds of much more of potential interest to mankind in his interest in his own population. One of the interesting things that can happen is that special requirements may be exhausted first. I recall quite vividly running into a situation in the Peace River when I was doing the preliminary biological survey up there in 1938. We found that there were very large areas that were well populated with such things as bluebirds and tree swallows and house wrens and things of this sort. And there were other apparently equally suitable areas that had none of them. Something was limiting these animals to certain particular areas. And there were also quite large numbers of these birds that weren't breeding at all. They were just hanging around. If you shot one of a pair from a nest, there was immediate replacement as a clear indication that there were all kinds of spare parts lying around waiting to take up the slack in any family vacancies. A closer look revealed an interesting situation. All these birds are what the bird watchers know as hole nesters. They nest in holes in tree trunks. And their main source of holes was a small woodpecker known as a yellow-breasted sapsucker. And the yellow-breasted sapsuckers were only nesting in aspen trees that were greater in basal diameter than 4 inches, because at this diameter, the aspen becomes rotten in the center, and it's easy digging. You drill a little hole in, you get a lot of pulpwood, you throw it out, and you're in business with a nest. So then, wherever you got aspens 4 inches or over, you got sapsuckers, tree swallows, bluebirds, house wrens, and all this rest of the gang that follow along behind. Aspens less than this, and you got none. This is just an example of special requirements. I could cite all sorts of other examples that make a large part of the population completely redundant so far as contributing to the general hilarity of the occasion is concerned. The limitation of security is another very interesting situation that can limit a population far short of its food potential. I can bring to mind two situations here. If you visit the Bass Rock or Ailsa Craig off the coast of Scotland, or one or other of these great nesting colonies of the gannets, those great white seabirds of the Atlantic Ocean and the southern shores, you will find that the earliest comers to the colony nest in the middle of the most inaccessible cliffs. Then little by little, the late comers fill up to the bottom of the cliff, to the top of the cliff, and out towards the edges, and then out onto the grassland. The ones in the center of the cliff have a far better history of raising their young than the ones on the edge of the cliff, because they're not molested by the other creatures of the environment that come along and eat up the eggs and destroy the young of those that are nesting in the insecure localities around the edge. So here then, secure nesting sites is what is contributing. We found in a study of the white sheep of McKinley Park in Alaska that the population, after a certain stage had been reached, was entirely limited by secure feeding habitats, that there was all kinds of excellent grassland for sheep that they couldn't use because there was a wolf sitting on top of every hill just waiting for them to come off that secure habitat. So the animals on the secure habitat raised their young successfully. Any excess that had to feed out over the edge was promptly eliminated. You'd have said it was wolf predation. Sure it was, but it was the security that was important. Food quality, not quantity, food quality is another one of the very important limitations on animal numbers. A long-time friend of mine, Dr. Ben Glading, has been studying quail in California for the last 25 years. He's beginning to know something about quail. One of the interesting things that he found was, after he had set up some very ingenious water-holding devices out on the prairies, out on the sagebrush deserts of central and eastern California, where there is a particular interesting species of quail called the Gamble's quail, he wondered why the creatures didn't increase. There was water, there was all kinds of food, you could prove it, but they didn't breed on certain years. Certain other years they bred handsomely, brought out all kinds of chicks, and there was good quail shooting. He found that if you didn't have November rains, you didn't get an early spring germination of flowering plants, and you didn't get the quail turning from their dry seeds to a diet that included green food, and if this didn't happen, the flocks didn't even break up. They didn't even get interested in each other. And the whole area would be devoid of any nests that year. This then was food quality. Apparently it was vitamin C that was deficient. And the vitamin C content of seeds is pretty low. Deer offer a number of interesting possibilities involved in food quality. The rate at which deer reproduce depends. 78% of the does became pregnant, a difference of 26%. Then as we looked at the does, we found that those on the good range were averaging 65% annual interest. Those on the poor range were averaging 10% annual interest in terms of numbers of young, number of eggs ovulated. Another thing that can happen in terms of age of sexual maturity under these circumstances, this is directly linked to food quality. In the good range, 39% of the fawns, the little things that had been spotties 4 months before, were becoming sexually mature when they were 5 months old and having their first children on their first birthdays. Now this just isn't decent in average deer range, and in poor deer range, it just doesn't happen at all. Our deer out here don't do it anyway. But in New York, they do. The 39% of them are becoming pregnant on their first autumn in the best ranges, 3% on the poor ranges, a difference of 36% here. And then if we looked at how many eggs these youngsters were ovulating, how many young they were starting per mother, 0.42 was the rate on the good range, 0.03 on the poor range. In other words, there's a 40% difference here. So when you add all these percentages together, those two populations of perfectly healthy deer had a very different rate of increase and were producing quite different results. Then you can get dramatic losses to disease. Bighorn sheep are particularly vulnerable to animal diseases. I recall one herd that I censused. It was the herd that winters down near Sinclair Canyon in Kootenai National Park. Some of you will have seen it. There were 160 head when I censused it in September. In November, I got an SOS that they were dying. In 1 month, we picked up 110 dead ones, and I found 20 more carcasses the next spring. This was a disease that wiped practically the whole herd out, cutting down to about 25 animals in a matter of a month. Well, these animals never reach the capacity that their environment has, because as soon as they reach a certain density, a disease nips them off. And one could keep on multiplying these examples. In carnivores, the flesh eaters, we have very few really objective studies. Flesh eaters are extraordinarily difficult to study. They're secretive creatures that don't lend themselves to the inquiring eyes of the biologist. One of the biologists at Oxford has done, though, a very interesting long-term study of owls in a wooded area close to Oxford. Owls are mouse eaters. This particular owl is the tawny owl, which will be well known to all of you who've had anything to do with cubs, even if you've never seen one. The tawny owl is a mouse eater. And owls have a very interesting way of adjusting their population to the food potential of their environment. They are food controlled, as are most of the predators. Owls lay, say, up to 5 or 6 eggs. And they start sitting on the first egg the day it's laid, and just lay the next one when it's ready to come along. Maybe next day, maybe 2 days. So that there may be a week or 8 or 9 days between the first egg laid and the last egg laid. So the first egg then has been sat on for a week before the last egg gets laid, and the chicks hatch seriatim. And the first baby is 7 days old before the last one hatches. The 7-day-old one, of course, is a pretty tough customer by that time. And if mice are short, he eats his brother that hatched the last time and then starts on the next one. Or if food is short, the one that is largest, hungriest, can reach tallest and open the biggest mouth gets fed first. So that you've got here a natural way of limiting the population. Lots of mice, they all get fed. Only a few mice, perhaps it gets fed halfway down. Virtually no mice, only the first one gets fed, or perhaps even that one doesn't get fed. And this is a very interesting way of rolling with the punch, being ready to capitalize on any situation which comes to your advantage, but being able to concentrate all your eggs in one basket or one baby, if that is the desirable thing to do from the standpoint of the population. The fate of a young owl is to replace its parents or perish. There are no vacant niches in this particular owl world. Well, this same sort of thing can happen in timber wolves. I made a 4-year study of timber wolf populations on one occasion. There were about 50 wolves in the area I was working in when I entered it, and there were still 50 wolves when I left it 5 years later, and I hadn't shot any in the meantime. After 5 years studying them, I'd only seen them once, but I learned a great deal about them without ever having to see them. It's a very interesting detective operation studying these carnivores. Something was preventing them from increasing. There were litters born every year. The she-wolves were pregnant every year, at least as far as I could tell they were, from every sign they were denning. But we found the answer as mange. Mange in the dens was killing the young. Mange to which the adults were no longer susceptible. And the number of young that were weaned and left the den then was only just enough to keep up with the annual wastage which takes any population. Now, one of the really interesting things that has recently been discovered about animal populations is that there is something about mere numbers that influences the way animals behave. At the experimental level, crowding and its consequences can be imposed by any circumstance that puts an animal into conflict with its neighbors. For food, for mates, for room, or for social position. Because every animal in a group has its own social position, and it's recognized by itself, it's recognized by the others. This business of the captain kicks the lieutenant and so on down the line to the poor boot private, it happens in the animal world just as it happens in the armies of our country and in our own women's organizations and men's organizations. There are the top dogs and there are the bottom dogs. There's the peck order in a hen flock and there's the hook order in any herd of cows. And any of you who have ever tried to go on a pack trip know what chaos you can create by trying to tie the wrong horse ahead of the right one. There's just nothing but trouble until you reverse them, and the pack train moves best in its social order. Now, there's been some very interesting experiments done to explore the meaning of this discovery. Recently, there have been some experiments done at the University of Glasgow using wild Norway rats. Now, the nature of the experiment was this. Quite large cages were taken, and into a cage would be, say, put 12 adult male rats. In another cage would be put 6 adult females and 6 adult males, cage the same size. And then in another cage, it was much smaller over here, but had the same square number of square feet per rat, would put a mated pair. Then you watch to see what happens in these situations. In the all-male group, a social order is very quickly established, and everything goes well. There's reasonably good survival. In the mated pair cage, there's no problems there that can't be settled very easily, because there's a social order arises quite quickly, and the pair knows who's boss, and everything goes on happily. In the male-female group, there is chaos that leads to a great deal of mortality. And the mortality always involves those in the low position on the social order, and it does not involve them being chewed to pieces. They die without wound. If you carry this further and take your all-male cage, which established its priority sequence and is living happily, and you introduce an interloper, a complete stranger, fellow from the wrong side of the tracks, the chances are that within a matter of hours he'll be dead, without a wound on his body. If you do the same thing, putting a stray female into this cage of mixed animals that's established itself, again, the interloper will die, usually without a mark on the body. And the same thing occurs if you put either sex into the mated pair's cage, though more quickly if it's a male that you put in. Apparently, all you can see is that the interloper is attacked. Now, the attack involves pushing with the front feet and threatening and chivying and chasing, a little mild biting, but nothing that makes a wound that's serious. And the animal, after a certain number of minutes or hours of this, goes into a state where it's simply cowering in the corner. One more attack and it rolls over on its back and dies. Now, apparently, this sort of happening, social attack to a rat, is one of the greatest insults that can be offered, an insult in the biological term which leads to death. Now, this was found also in the field mice by Dr. Dennis Chitty of Oxford University. And one of Dr. Chitty's students made a very interesting study of partridges. And he watched the partridge flocks of winter break up in the spring as the great biological urge hit them, and they were no longer living comfortably as a flock. They started to break up into pairs. And on this particular study area, every partridge carried its own little label. They'd all been trapped and tagged during the winter. So if you look at every partridge on a field, there's a little leather harness around the base of each wing, and right on the middle of its back, it carried a big black number on a yellow plastic tag, so that you could identify every bird with your field glasses. This man, watching the partridges, noted how many minutes each of these birds was fighting, running away, or being quiet. The ones that had to fight were the ones that weren't in the top social position. The ones in the top social position just have to look at the other one, and they recognize this social position, and there's no more conflict. Being top dog has distinct advantages. Mere threat is all that is necessary. You don't have to assert yourself anymore. It was found that those that were constantly chivied had the highest rate of irritation, and chivying had the smallest number of eggs, the smallest hatching success of the eggs they did lay, the lowest survival of the chicks that hatched, and this business carried on for about three generations. The population, something had happened to those individuals, which carried through from egg to egg for three generations in inducing a higher mortality rate for those in low social position. Recently, it's been suggested that something the same works in one kind of deer, but we doubt this. Recent studies in Australia with rabbits has showed us quite clearly that we were wrong in assuming that this was a fairly general thing, and we've got to do a great deal more work before we know what kinds of animals are involved in this. We know now that rabbits are not involved in it, that rabbits have almost the same capacity to live under slum conditions that man has without interfering with their reproductive effectiveness. Another interesting item that one can study is the disadvantages and advantages of doing your conflict before the need arises. In other words, establishing your right to a territory, because this is all it is. Most birds sing not because they're happy, but because their adrenal glands are kicking them around, and their pituitaries are active, and they can't do anything else about it. They sing to establish a territory. If they cannot establish a territory, they will not make a nest, and they will not bring off young. This territory is absolutely a sine qua non of essential reproduction. Now, a great many creatures are this way. No territory, no breeding. And this territory is the area upon which they will make their nest and raise their young. And apparently it has about the right area through the history and experience of the population to provide the food that is necessary to feed the young. It also permits the animal to become thoroughly familiar with every possibility of escape on this area, so that on this area it knows all the nicks and crannies and can get away from its enemies. Now this then, this business of conflict for territory, is avoiding the issue before it happens. They don't have to fight for food because they've established it when they establish their territory. This has advantages. It also has disadvantages. And here again, you can draw human parallels that I'll try and point out to you very shortly. If you want to go down to Stanley Park, you'll find two kinds of squirrels living in Stanley Park. Gray squirrels, which were introduced from Ontario, and red squirrels, or Douglas chicorees, which are our native ones. The chicoree, our native one, is territorial. He establishes his rights to a maple tree and a cedar tree nearby, and that's it. No interlopers. You interlope and get your ear chewed off. Or usually, if you own this territory, the interloper knows he's an interloper, and this puts him in a very poor position to make a success of his invasion. A possession, being 9/10 of the law, holds almost every time in the psychological level in animal populations. The owner almost always wins, and usually doesn't even have to fight. But the gray squirrel is non-territorial. Now, for red squirrels, this is an advantage. They live in an environment in which food is rather scarce, and they require the exclusive use of certain food stocks. The gray squirrel lives normally in an environment in which food is not very scarce, and they are not territorial. They have their own little area around the nest, which they defend, but they feed at large over a very big area. Now, what happens when these two come into conflict? The red squirrel can beat up any one of those gray squirrels, even though they're 3 times his weight, and does when they try to invade his food stocks. But while he's chasing this one, the one over here is eating his food supply. And when he chases that one, another one over here is eating his food supply, because these gray squirrels are feeding all together in a herd. So even though the red squirrel is individually completely dominant, he's simply driven off the areas that are invaded by the gray squirrel, who are not dominant at all. Now this has some very interesting counterparts that I'm sure I don't have to point out in detail. This works when certain kinds of creatures come into conflict. Now this is then a very brief introduction to some of the things that influence animal populations. Now with considerable temerity, I'd like to turn my sights around and look very briefly at what we can see in certain primitive human populations. I hesitate to get into this business of the problem of human numbers because so much has been written, so much that is good and sensible, and so much that is utter rubbish. And it's often very difficult to distinguish between the two. You may have trouble also. In general, man has a unique capacity that no other animal has to lift the food ceiling and to alter the environmental resistance at almost every point. Now, this is one of the things that we don't see mentioned very often that is distinctively and completely uniquely human, that no other creature has. It's one of the reasons why we can say, yes, man is an animal, but he's also more than that. He's a completely unique kind of animal. He also has been able to avoid fatal or restrictive stress phenomena by elaborate social ingenuity. In other words, he doesn't suffer from the problems that other animals suffer by virtue of contact of numbers, because he's been very ingenious in inventing a social organization that permits him to live together without too much stress. Almost every culture, primitive or modern, has developed this social organization, and it has evolved with the culture to take care of emerging situations as they occur. This, again, is a unique human capacity. There's plenty of evidence that primitive man was food limited, that was famine was his normal environmental control, and that he was strongly territorial. But there was also plenty of evidence that he was intelligently interested in the problem of his own numbers. Unfortunately, the sociologist, the demographer, the student of human numbers has very recently become interested in man. and we have all too few well-documented cases of primitive populations and how they were behaving. I know a little bit from personal experience about the Eskimo culture, a hunter culture, in which social position was gained by the best hunter by being able to distribute food to his confreres. And the stature of the individual depended upon his ability as a hunter as well as his sagacity as a leader. These two things were almost parallel. Now here I'm probably doing a great injustice to some of my sociological colleagues who could correct me in point of detail, but this is the way I saw it and I interpreted it. I may be wrong. In times of stress, it was extremely important to occupy one of these high social positions, because in almost all primitive cultures, the man of high social position was a valuable man to the group, and the group concentrated on having him survive because of his value to the group. And I think this is one of the most important advantages of social position, no matter how it is achieved. It's equally cogent in man and in animals, as we've seen. There was no selective, at least there was very strong selective priority then to the good hunter, to the able-bodied male, to the sagacious individual, particularly the sagacious male. Under times of stress, suicide and infanticide were both practiced in this hunter culture. We have no record, however, of contraceptive practices, of purposeful attempts to restrict births. Another very interesting study, and this time of an agrarian culture, can be found in Dr. Raymond Firth's two studies of the Tikopia people of Polynesia. These people were examined twice by Dr. Raymond Firth, once in 1929, when he published a very interesting book called We, the Tikopia, and again in 1952, when he returned. Now, over this period of 23 years, the average annual interest rate, that's the average rate of increase, had been 1.5%, as nearly as I can figure it from the estimates that are given. This is very low when we compare it to our current 12%, that's average over the human population of the world today. By very good fortune for Dr. Firth, if not for the Tikopia, a severe famine struck the islands while he was there in 1952. Two hurricanes virtually eliminated the food supply. And he was able to see these people under stress. Now, there were nearly 2 months' food supply was imported in terms of rice as an emergency measure from outside. So this then altered the whole situation. The famine was a failure because of this food that was brought in. But during this 12 months, the mortality rate was 4 times the normal mortality rate. 89 people died, 7 of them directly of starvation, others of other factors which were complicated by malnutrition and starvation. And the majority of the surplus deaths were children under the age of 18, which is a very usual situation in native populations under famine circumstances. He found that the stress of food, though, was social, every bit as much as it was nutritional. It involved emotional attitudes towards the hunger of wife and children. It involved the moral attitudes towards the giving of food to a starving neighbor. It involved the social attitude toward the ceremonial use of food, which was one of the most important uses of food in the normal culture of the Polynesian. Festivities of one sort or another were always accompanied by the transfer of foodstuffs, marriages, deaths, and so on, were always celebrated or signified by the transfer of foods. A famine alters all this, and it produces great social stress. The results, then, that he observed were direct starvation, a tremendous increase in stealing, strife, real conflict for food, many discussions of potential suicide, which in culture simply means getting into your canoe and sailing away into the sea, to die by the sea rather than to die by starvation, and discussions of migration. They recognized the reason behind this problem, too many people. He interestingly records that the ceremonial use of food survived. There was absolutely no profit ever was attached to food, even when it was scarce. Nobody was bartering food for any other advantage or for any other goods or services. Food, then, they were able to maintain as a social feature, not as a feature of wealth. The famine reinforced the concern over the population increase, but migration was the only answer that was suggested. They recognized there were too many people, that there must be other places which had too few people, and they talked about going. But the social cohesion of the group was too great for them ever to get around to doing it. So they sat there and starved, talking about going somewhere where the feeding conditions were better. Contraception was practiced on this island. Contraception of their own design, not white suggested, but it was not practiced to reduce the population. It was practiced when a family decided that it had all the children it wanted. And this had nothing to do with the philosophical concept of too many people. On one of the other Polynesian islands, the island of Yap, it was practiced for reasons of population control. Here, though, it was abortion that was practiced. And for some peculiar reason, this became part of the social structure of the people. And the island of Yap has since suffered a great depopulation from other causes, mainly white-introduced disease. But abortion has become so much part of the social pattern that it still continues and is doing the people here now a considerable disservice. I don't want to enter the modern scene at all in terms of trying to analyze the hopelessly complicated social organization that man has built for himself in so short a time. Today, we face an enigma we seem incapable of solving. The rate of increase of 12% is still on the exponential phase of my graph. It's still rising sharply at an even percentile base. And even though the ceiling can be raised and will be raised, there is an obvious upper limit to what can be done in terms of producing food and other human necessities on the Earth's surface. It can be predicted that deterioration of the social environment, in the largest sense, will, I'm sure, precede the reaching of the food ceiling. Deterioration will be uneven over the world and will induce various aspects of unrest that we see in animals, that we saw in primitive culture, and we see still in modern culture. The unrest that leads to strife and has led in the past to many of the unrest that we call war. Man apparently lacks the sensitive mechanisms of many species of lower mammals that reduce the birth rate far short of the scale of widespread famine. His social organization and his ingenuity have permitted his escape from many of the normal consequences of overcrowding. But overpopulation can only be met in one of two ways, eventually: starvation deaths, eliminating the surplus, or the development, the invention of a substitute, sensitive process that will operate short of famine. Sir Charles Darwin, in his Reith Lectures of 1958, examined the consequences of voluntary restriction of numbers, what we call Planned Parenthood or birth control, on less than a worldwide basis. He has suggested that if half the population decided that they wanted a world of luxury and not of numbers, and opted for control of the population, in a little less than a generation, this half of the world's population would only be a third of the world's population. In a matter of a very few years, they would be an insignificant part of the world's population. And he then goes on to say that this would lead to the extinction of this part of the world population that opted for comfort and planning of the family number on a national basis. However, there seems to me to be cogent evidence that mere numbers are no longer the absolute criterion for survival. It seems to me that we are now in a different kind of circumstance, and that numbers beyond a point may mean national poverty, not national survival and prosperity. Survival today, and even more to me in the future, depends upon the effectiveness of social organization, the breadth and depth of our education that can lead to the most ingenious and the most effective use of men and human environment. I'm convinced that the new struggle for survival is at the socio-intellectual level and does not require for its inauguration the worldwide occurrence of conditions of resource exhaustion. The principles that can be learned from the study of animal numbers have not been transcended. The principles still operate, but the means of application are unique. In spite of what has been said about human populations, I contend that all we can do today is to point out the problem, and that we really don't know the answers, but we must strive hard to find them. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Dr. McTaggart-Cowan will answer a few questions this evening, so we'll take those now for a few minutes. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if the speaker is suggesting that in spite of all man's predatory habits, that nature will eventually strike a balance in every realm of life. Now, in that connection, I'm thinking of the author of the book Serengeta Shall Not Die. He says, since during the last 2,000 years, approximately 106 species of animals and birds have become totally extinct. Now, there doesn't seem to be a balance from there at all.
That is quite true, but the two situations are unrelated. Many, many millions of animals have become extinct, or at least not millions, maybe even millions, but many thousands anyway, have become extinct. It is theoretically possible for man to become extinct if he is unsuccessful in adapting to the environmental circumstances that he builds for himself. It's theoretically possible for any creature to become extinct. But we assume prior to that and without evidence of extinction, which we see no reason to believe. There is no evidence of impending extinction in human biology. Animals that are suffering from impending extinction show very clear signs of it in their falling reproductive rate, in the failure of many individuals in the population to establish mates. We've watched this happen. We're watching it, watching the struggle. Probably the most dramatic one today on this continent is the struggle of the whooping crane to survive. It's been plus or minus one or two of 30 individuals for the last 20 years, and it's just hanging on the balance. A very small, 30 individuals go north and two young come back with them. This is the sort of thing that indicates extinction impending. Now, we do have some completely unknown cataclysms in the past. The extinction of the native wild horses of America is completely inexplicable. The extinction of the mammoths and the other great elephants of this continent has no known reason that we can postulate. But these are things that could have been predicted long before they happened by a student of the biology of those animals. We don't know what the answer is, but we can tell they're going to happen.
Stay there. I guess we're going to have to move on. You've answered all my questions, I think. Ladies and gentlemen, are there any other questions? It appears that Dr. McTaggart-Cowan has answered all of the queries that you might have had before entering here tonight.
Jim,
yes, sir.
In this question of extinction,
yes.
Yes, man is a very important part of the environment of animals other than himself. But it is not proven that man has notably increased the extinction rate of creatures on the world's surface. There may have been eras before. Take the era toward the end of the Cretaceous, when the world's stock of giant reptiles was disappearing. There may have been periods in that time. These have been postulated, but certainly in the last century, we know of no other century that's equaled it in terms of the number of animals that have become extinct. But this again is the part of the story of man's position in his environment. Well, the mammals in Africa, it is very likely that a third of the species of large mammals of Africa will not survive the present resurgent nationalism, except on a few parks which may be protected. It's a tragic thing that to watch throughout the world, that resurgent nationalism, which displaces a stable situation, which has built up a stable legal system or protective system of the natural products, including the animals of an environment, one of the first things that's thrown out by the new government are the conservation legislation which was imposed on the population by the preceding government. And they do not realize that the wild species of their habitat are just as intrinsically important and part of the environment as the men in it themselves. And I doubt that there's much chance of them realizing it before it's too late. This has happened all over Southeast Asia. The great large wild species of Thailand, of Malaya, of Burma, of Vietnam, of parts of Pakistan, parts of India, are just on the way out. They're not going to survive. But this is another long story.
Yes, sir.
He can't reestablish the environment in its entirety by any manner of means, no. Man has seized control over the environment which he seeks to manipulate in his interest only. And sometimes he misinterprets his interest.
Yeah, but what I mean, sir, is isn't it possible for the human race to live in such a way that they would maintain nature's balance?
Very
can
possible.
Can they live any other way?
Very possible. Very possible. But we just don't. I couldn't agree with you more. I feel exactly as you do. And I think one of the most tragic things that's going to happen as a result of increasing numbers is the complete ruination of the habitat that you and I and thousands like us regard as the only fit environment in which to have our children and live our lives.
Now, are there any other questions?
Can man meet the competition from other orders? Is there a possibility of the human race being replaced by insects?
You don't have a...
No.
We'll have an entomologist on the next series. Now, if you'll put your hand up, then I'll know if there's not any more questions.
No, there's nothing so desperately secret. What I wanted to imply was that they're very difficult to study because they're secretive. In other words, they live by stealth. They're part of their life is involved in keeping out of sight. And we are animals of sight. Most carnivores are animals of a world of smell. And the needs of the two are quite different. This is one of the main reasons, I think, why there are probably 100 ornithologists to every mammalogist. Birds live by their eyes, and so do we. And it's much more fun to live with them for those people who like to follow creatures around. It's easier.
Dr. Eastman.
Just a simple question. In countries like our own, do the game law not aim at its control that you were speaking of the balance and so on? Isn't that whole idea of inspectors and changing?
Yes, sir. The situation in North America is based upon a biological knowledge of a population and an attempt to maintain the population. Actually, what we strive to do in the populations that are being used by man as game or for fur or whatever purpose we use them, we try to keep the population at that critical point on this great S-curve right in the middle. where the summit of the bell-shaped curve is. Now, this means the animals are being produced at the most rapid rate, but that the environment isn't full, and the animals are not damaging their environment. It's a tricky place to keep it, but that's what we strive to do with reasonable success.
Would
hemorrhagic you? Septicemia.
Well, I would like to ask another question.
Oh, would you wait?
I think this is a very fundamental subject, and I'm surprised there aren't a great...
Well, sir, if you just... We'll just see if there are...
No, I noticed the two...
Will you just wait, and I'll see if there are any other questions.
Oh, all right.
They just take a little time sometimes in incubating, you know. Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
Just
a minute. I'll let Dean Perry ask a question, eh?
That would require a sensitivity of testing, as I'm sure you appreciate, that is very difficult to achieve. What does emerge, though, is a survival of the socially dominant. This is true at the individual level. In certain creatures, it carries forward. For instance, Dr. Lorentz quite clearly showed that the mating of the top dominant male with a female very low in the dominance order led to her assuming the number two position in the hierarchy. In other words, the mayor's wife was the mayor's wife, even though she had originated well down the social scale. But this does lead, though, to survival of the individuals which have that capacity for establishing dominance, for establishing a high social position. Now, there are two things that can be achieved. Maintenance of the high level that is there, or improvement of the level. And this would require judgments that haven't yet been made. After all, the experimental field that I'm reporting to you, the experiments I'm reporting to you, were done last year and have been done on only three kinds of animals out of the 30,000 kinds of vertebrates or more that are available.
Take one more question, sir. Can you close the question period? Yes.
Well, it wasn't exactly a question.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask the speaker, though, in a sense, what he thinks of the Tourist Association of Canada. Incidentally, are trying to promote the migration to this country of European so-called sportsmen, wealthy sportsmen. They claim they think this is a little too hot in Africa for them now, so they want to bring them over here. In fact, almost the words that were used, and they're going to hunt in the Rocky Mountain ranges and other ranges in this country. Now, what effect will that have on the animal population?
Well, this is quite an easy one to answer. There are very large areas of the province, north of the main line of the CNR, from Prince Rupert to Jasper, which are under-harvested, if what you're looking at is a harvest, in which, for instance, take if you want, bighorn, which is one of the animals that many sportsmen will travel around the world to get, the bighorn sheep. The annual harvest of bighorn sheep in the whole of British Columbia doesn't run more than about 100 head. Now, you could take this number out of about 1,300 animals annually, and we've got far more animals than that. So that there are many stocks in the province that are available for this type of expanded hunting, which are not being used by our own sportsmen, and if you're not certainly going to do any damage to the population, which is what we're concerned about now. The ethics is something quite different that we're not discussing.
Thank you. I think, ladies and gentlemen, that we've kept Dr. Taggart Cowan to answer a great number of questions. I now ask Dr. Henry Johnson of our College of Education to thank our speaker for us this evening.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it is certainly a pleasure tonight to be able to thank our speaker, Dr. Cowan. I think that I represent probably a large segment of the audience in being a layman scientifically, and I think probably we scientific laymen are most appreciative of this kind of a lecture. I remember when I was in the same class as Dr. Cowan at university, I was the non-scientific type who would look through a microscope and see nothing but Campbell's soup. I appreciate this kind of a lecture very much. I remember Stephen Leacock once said that some people can tire of a lecture in 10 minutes and clever people can do it in 5. But I think you'd have to be very clever indeed to tire of this lecture. May I also say that we have enjoyed, Dr. Cowan, your TV lectures on Sunday afternoon. I hope that these TV lectures were given in the city of Toronto, because that would certainly solve the problem Sunday afternoon. My family has competed very successfully with Pat Masterson and Wyatt Burke. This has been a very, very fascinating evening, Chairman. We've been introduced to these animal populations and this interesting phenomenon of environmental resistance. We've met these pregnant doves. We've met the Norway rats that are so skeptical socially. And the tawny owls and the sapsuckers that provide homes for indigent rain.
You'll have to admit the class of 32 did pretty well. Well, now, I'm sure, ladies and gentlemen, as our last questioner made note of, and I think he expressed the views of many of us, that this is a very, very important subject in this day. And you'll be pleased to hear, of course, many of you know, that this lecture is one in a series of two, of which Dr. Cowan took the question of the animal population, the expanding animal population, and his distinguished, very distinguished colleague in England will be with us on a Wednesday, not a Saturday night, on the 29th, when Sir Charles Darwin will discuss the subject, the expanding human population. So I'm sure that this will complete a series which many of us have been looking forward to. Now, next week, the second to the last lecture, we will have the pleasure of hearing from our new head of the Department of Economics at the University, Dr. John Young, and he will speak to you on the subject, Canada's Trade and Your Prosperity. We invite you to be here at 8:15 in this hall next Saturday night.